Morning, everybody. I mentioned here before that my college roommate became a lawyer for a big law firm in Columbus, Ohio, after we graduated. For about 35 years, he was doing that, doing the lawyer thing, and also attending the Vineyard Church in Columbus, Ohio. Over the years, he rose to a position of prominence in his firm, while still leading Bible studies at the church and even occasionally preaching on Sunday morning. And in fact, for many years, he was leading a once-a-week Bible study at the law firm. For a while, he was on the executive committee for the law firm. I remember he used to say to me when we talked about, you know, how I was, you know, getting involved in this church, becoming a pastor, he was doing the lawyer thing. He used to say he just wanted to show the folks at the law firm that it was possible to be a person of faith and not be a goofball. During his years there, he actually became something of the firm chaplain. It went a lot further than just showing them that he wasn't a goofball. Over time, eventually, whenever anybody was having trouble in life, they would come to him as their listening ear, their wise counselor, and sometimes as somebody that would pray for them. Over those 35 years, he was asked several times to officiate at weddings and funerals of people in the law firm. He became their go-to person. About 4 years ago, he retired and took a job as an education pastor at the Columbus Vineyard Church. And when he left, almost everybody in the firm came by to say goodbye. And one of the lawyers, the partners that had been there the whole time said, you know, none of us are surprised that you're taking early retirement to do this. But you need to know that we've been completely changed because of you. When he started, he was the only person of faith in the firm, and they looked at him skeptically. And by the time he left, a significant number of the lawyers in the firm were also people of faith, and the whole atmosphere was completely changed. In fact, some of the people were crying as he left because they were losing, as it were, their work chaplain. I think he's an excellent example of how to be the church at work. We're doing a series of messages about be the church, trying to explore what does it mean when we say go out into the world and be the church, and how do we live this out in real life? Now, last week we talked about work and how work is meant to be a good thing, how work is a gift from God, how work is a way to serve our neighbors and also serve God, and how work is something we should see as a concrete way to worship Jesus. It's not a curse, it's a good thing. And so this week, we're going on from that, and we're asking the question, if that's the case, how do we practically work out being the church at work? Whether our work is in the marketplace, at home, at school, or wherever it is, how would Jesus want us to behave in our workplace in order to be a good representative of what it means to be a person connected to God? Now, there's a character in the Bible named Daniel, who is probably the most successful character in terms of being God's person in the workplace that you can find in the Bible. I mean, this man was amazing. In 606 BC, and we can actually nail down the year, in fact, we can get it almost down to the month and the date, Daniel was taken as a very young man. He was probably from a prominent family among the people of Israel. He was taken as a captive from his home in Jerusalem, marched east to Babylon, and there was forced to serve the king of Babylon. Because of his education, his gifts, his background, he served the king directly in the palace. Now, the Babylonian kings, shall we say, were not what we would today consider nice people. They were utterly ruthless, often cruel, often corrupt in all kinds of ways, with no regard at all for human rights and dignity. They wouldn't even understand the phrase. To them, there was only one person who had any rights whatever, and that was the king. And that is where Daniel found himself. And he lived out the rest of his life there in Babylon, in the heart of darkness, as it were, where he served as a high political official a total of at least 7 kings, not of his own nation, including the first couple kings of the Persians, who at the end of his life came in and conquered the Babylonians, who decided, this guy's so good, we're going to have him work for us too. The interesting thing is they all wanted Daniel, and they all raised him up to positions of great power and responsibility. So the question is, how did he do it, and what can we learn from it? Because maybe we can learn about how to behave at our work in such a way as to be successful in being the church. So let's take a look at a few selections from the story of Daniel. We'll start in Daniel chapter 1, verse 8, and we'll kind of skip along through. And this is right after we jump into the story right after Daniel arrives in Babylon. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. And he's not meaning getting fired. Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. And their mothers cheered. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. And at the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus, which is significant because that's 8 kings later. Or I think maybe 7 kings. Early on, there was a crisis. The king had a dream that troubled him. He wanted it interpreted, but he decided, I'm not going to tell the dream. I want something that's verifiably supernatural. So he announced to all of his wise men, I had a dream that bothers me. Tell me what my dream is, and then tell me how to interpret it. There was a big argument that ensued between the king and the astrologers and the wise men, because they said, well, tell us the dream, and then we'll tell you what it means. And he says, no, I'm not going to tell you. You're going to tell me what the dream was. And the argument continued, and that's where we're going to jump in. Verse 8, then the king answered, I am certain you're trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. And the astrologers answered the king, there's no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men in Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death, because they were counted among the wise men. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. And he asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? And Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. And at this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and he urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision, and Daniel praised the God of heaven. And he told the dream to the king, and he interpreted the dream for the king, and everybody's lives was saved. Towards the end of Daniel's life, he found himself working for the Persian kings. And during that time, he ends up getting thrown into a den of lions and miraculously saved. It was a rough business politics in those days. And, of course, that story is the part that most people hear and remember. But for our purposes, it's actually more useful to see how the whole lion's den situation came about. And just backing it up a little bit, here's how the story goes. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. He had served a lifetime, and they could find nothing. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We'll never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever." And the royal administrators and prefects and satraps and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, when Daniel learned of the decree that had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God, just as he had done before. And that's how he ended up in the den of lions. But he was saved. Now, through these passages, there are a number of clues as to how Daniel was so successful. And what you have to understand is a hostile, toxic workplace. He was successful by any earthly measure of respect, power, or honors. I mean, probably almost unmatched in the history of mankind, in fact. And he was also very successful as a man openly connected to God, keeping his integrity and faith over a lifetime of this amazing career, not chosen by him, but nevertheless incredibly successful, basically, in politics for the strongest empires of his time. And there are several points that I've taken from this story. And then I've added just a couple at the end from the New Testament to come up with what I'm calling 10 commandments for your workplace. I thought, you know, we're close to 10. Let's just make it 10. All right, so 10 commandments for your workplace for how to be the church there. Number one, don't compromise your integrity. Daniel's first rule for living and working in Babylon was he wasn't going to compromise. To start with, that meant not to eat the king's meat. And you think, what? Is this because he's a vegetarian? And the answer is no, not exactly. The problem was that Daniel knew that any meat would have been meat that had been sacrificed to Babylonian idols, so it was spiritually tainted. In essence, he wasn't going to compromise his faith. It was a faith issue. And he would faithfully live for and worship the God of Israel exclusively, no matter what the what. And that carried through his whole life, right down to what got him into the den of lions. He didn't compromise in any other ways as well. He was going to tell the truth. He wasn't going to take bribes or change his rulings or his behavior because somebody put pressure on him. You know, corruption was the norm of his day. We may think of our politics today as corruption, but you haven't seen anything, not even in Chicago. not compared to what Daniel was living with. Okay, it was really a significant issue. It was the norm of the day, but it was never going to be his norm. And here's the thing you have to understand. No lie lives forever. Eventually, the truth always comes out. Any success that is based upon lying to the customer or secret deals with the decision maker will one day come to light. And then where will you be? No lie lives forever. Yes, as a mechanic, you can tell their customers they need work they really don't need and jack up the bill. But you'll never get customer loyalty and referrals that way. It won't lead to long-term success. There's a woman who wrote in Forbes magazine back in 2012 about the importance of integrity. So she's writing to business people, not people of faith. And she says, if I could teach only one value to live by, it would be this. Success will come and go, but integrity is forever. Integrity means doing the right thing at all times and in all circumstances, whether or not anyone is watching. It takes having the courage to do the right thing no matter what the consequences will be. Building a reputation of integrity takes years, but it takes only a second to lose. So never allow yourself to ever do anything that would damage your integrity. We live in a world where integrity isn't talked about nearly enough. We live in a world where the end justifies the means has become an acceptable school of thought for far too many. Salespeople overpromise and underdeliver, all in the name of making their quota for the month. Applicants exaggerate in job interviews because they desperately need a job. Sooner or later, no matter where you work, someone or some situation will challenge your integrity. And in that moment, you need to remember that you are really working for Jesus. That's not her word. I finished the quote. Now, that's me, okay? Somebody's going to challenge your integrity, and you have to remember that you're really working for Jesus. You need to remember that integrity is going to lead to long-term rewards, and it's going to take courage. Imagine the courage that Daniel had to have, but it will be worth it. There was a guy who lived here in the Chicago area a few years back, but he was still alive when I first moved to Chicago. His name was W. Clement Stone. He was a big insurance magnet and started some of the companies that have now become, I think, Aon or one of those biggies. Anyway, he lived here in Chicago for many years, and one time he said it this way. He says, have the courage to say no. Have the courage to face the truth. Do the right thing because it is right. These are the magic keys to living your life with integrity. So that's rule number one. Don't compromise your integrity. Rule number two, help your coworkers. Now, right at the first, Daniel has established a relationship with this guy who's a chief official responsible for all these new recruits, as it were. And he is responsible for their food. And so when Daniel objects to the food and says, I don't really want to eat your food, he objects for fear that if the food isn't good, then Daniel and his friends won't be presentable to the king, and that will cost him his head, not just his job. So this guy's on pins and needles. So Daniel, interestingly, doesn't dig in his heels and says, well, like a lumpet, we're not eating that food, so give us our vegetables. That's not what he does. Instead, he devises a plan that takes into consideration the needs of this official. He thinks about his needs, and he suggests, okay, let's do a test, a short test, 10 days, of an alternate diet, and we'll go with what is best at the end of the 10 days. In essence, Daniel has agreed to say, I will eat your food if we don't look better on our food at the end of 10 days. So he was thinking about the problem from this other guy's point of view, from this Babylonian official's point of view, and in the end helped him do his job well. In fact, in the end, as a result of this little test, everybody lost their meat and they all ate vegetables. The important point, of course, is sort of the attitude that Daniel had. And it's interesting because you have to remember, Daniel is a captive. He's been ripped from his home, taken in chains to Babylon, put in this place. This is the guy that's kind of his jailer slash, you know, trainer. And yet he's thinking about him and that guy's needs as well. If you want to do well at work, be someone who is known for helping your coworkers be a success. Because that's, in essence, what Daniel's doing. He's helping this guy be a success. You know, most people are trying to step on the next person in order to try to get ahead. But over the long haul, the ones that win, the ones that are the most appreciated, the ones who are the most successful are the ones who work to make everybody else a success. A while back, a man came to talk to me about some of his work problems. He had recently been made manager of several people, and one of the people he was assigned was a woman who was very combative. She had had a complete breakdown with several previous managers. They were on the verge of firing her, but she happened to be the salesman responsible for one of their biggest clients, and the client loved her. But everybody else hated her. And so it kind of was lined up that he was going to be the fall guy. He was going to be the one that had to fire her and kind of take the lumps. And I suggested to him, why don't you try to figure out what it is she needs? What are her motivations? And see if you can kind of come up with a new approach that will work for her. If you can get inside her head and figure out what it is that she needs and what motivates her and use that, you can turn this situation around. So he had another couple conversations with her. He figured it out, what was sort of her driving forces, completely changed the management style with her, came up with a new approach, and it was like night and day. She started thriving. She thinks he's the best manager he's ever had. His supervisor says, well, it looks like everybody else mismanaged her, and you're the first one that's done it right. So his supervisor thinks he's a genius for turning a bad situation completely around. And the interesting thing is, all it took was a few minutes, actually, of trying to think about how do we help her. So help your coworkers. Number three, be humble. You know, now it doesn't say anywhere in this passage that Daniel was humble. But to my eyes, at least, to my sense, there's a humble quality in the way he is speaking and behaving with everybody through the whole story. You know, there's no point where he's like looking down his nose at them, where he's condemning them. You guys are, you know, you're corrupt, dirty pagans. There's no sense of that anywhere in the story as he's talking to these people, you know. They're like his enemies. It would be like you'd be captured and taken to, you know, the Taliban headquarters or something, you know. But that never seems to come out. He's always got this humble, respectful demeanor to everybody he's behaving with all the way through. And even though Daniel and his friends were rated to be far better than any others in the king's service, they never seemed to put any airs on or took all the credit for themselves. James 4:10 tells us, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. Those who are humble, God will exalt. And it works at work as well. You know, in most workplaces, the one who rubs his or her success in everybody else's face becomes a target. And everybody else is trying to cut them down to size. But the one who is humble and shares credit with everybody else is the one that everyone wants to work with. Have you ever noticed that on the Survivor reality shows, the first person voted off is usually the know-it-all that's trying to tell everybody else what to do? The one that treats everybody else with condescension. So humility actually works. And, you know, sometimes the politics at work can get pretty ugly. But let me tell you, it's nothing like what Dinah had to deal with, where politics can actually get you ripped apart by lions, literally. And one of the keys to his survival through all the political ups and downs, humility. Don't make more enemies than you need to. And humility helps a lot. Rule number four for the workplace. Explain, don't preach or argue. Now, it's striking to me what's not in Daniel's account anywhere. Daniel is in the king's palace in the capital city of an empire made great by conquest, an empire engaged in the worship of idols and gods of nature, and even the worship of as a god of living kings. And here he's a devout Jew who believes in the one and only, invisible and all-powerful God who created everything and treats idol worship as spiritual adultery. But there's no place in the story where Daniel gets kind of on a soapbox and condemns the Babylonians for all their evil practices, or where he argues with them about their religious beliefs, or where he preaches at them. Now, that does not mean that he doesn't talk about God. He does talk about God. When he comes in with the dream, tells Nebuchadnezzar, okay, I can tell you your dream. He says, God showed it to me. The God who made everything showed me your dream. And here's what your dream is. And here's what. So he does that, but he never argues. He never preaches. There's never this sense of him like pointing at them and saying, I'm right and you're all wrong. Rather, it's just like part of his, he's just authentic to the way that he is, to his own faith, and explains when asked. In the same way, we should not hide the fact that we are people of faith without at the same time slipping into preaching or an argumentative posture. Because when we start preaching or arguing with people, mostly that just pushes people away, or maybe even gives them the wrong idea about Jesus. When people ask us, we should be ready to explain our faith, but we should never be trying to push our faith upon them. Because if they see Jesus in us, Jesus says they'll be drawn to him naturally, not pushed towards him. So explain, be authentic, but don't preach and don't argue. Rule number five, be faithful and reliable. At the end of his life, Daniel's qualities were so outstanding that the king desired to put him in charge of the whole kingdom. And, of course, these other officials who wanted that job for themselves tried to find something in Daniel's long history of government service that they could use to accuse him of. And when you think about, you know, how many politicians can serve for 50 years and not have something to criticize? But these guys could find nothing. They couldn't find anything. And eventually they realized they could only get rid of him on the basis of his faith somehow, so they concocted the no prayer to anybody but the king for 30 days as a way to do it. What gave Daniel such success and such influence was that he was always faithful and reliable in his job, far above anybody else. You know, and when the king needed somebody to do a hard job that he could count on to get it done, Daniel was his go-to guy. And if we're going to do well at work as representatives of Jesus and his church, then we've got to be the most faithful and reliable employees in the place. We've got to be the ones who always do their homework. We've got to be the ones who always communicate well and meet the deadlines and do what we say we're going to do. For the last almost 30 years now, I've been working with a couple of churches in Turkey, Istanbul. And these churches are made up of people who are from Muslim backgrounds but who have become believers of Jesus. And the way it works in Turkey is they actually, like, as they come to faith in Jesus, because they have a strong identity, stronger identity as Turkish people than as Muslim people, they actually change their ID cards. In Turkey, all your ID cards, like your driver's license cards, has your religion on it. And so they petition the government and change their ID cards from Muslim to Christian. And this was the decision of the Turkish believers, that they would do it that way. Now, one of the things, the interesting things, is that Turkey has universal military service for all the men. So as long as you're an able-bodied man, you have to serve in the Turkish military, and they, depending on the unemployment rate, sometimes for a year and sometimes for 3 years. They just move it up and down depending on how many unemployed people they have. And it's sort of a way to keep the employment rate even. And but everybody has to do military service, and you can't be a self-respecting Turkish man if you haven't done your military service. And the military, of course, knows all about the fact that you've changed your religion on your ID card. So at the beginning, when this started happening, we were always wondering what's going to happen when they get to the military to do their military service. Because Turkish military service, shall we say, is it has something of a reputation for mistreatment of the recruits in general anyway. And so, you know, we were thinking, like, oh boy, these guys, they're going to look in the folder and they're going to say, oh, this guy was Muslim, now he's changed his thing to Christian, you know, what's going to happen? Well, what ended up happening was, is they all ended up working in the offices of the commanding officers, because they were the only ones who would tell the truth and who would show up for work not drunk. Which was interesting, since the Christians are allowed to drink and the Muslims aren't. But what they found was that these Christians, these people who've changed their ID to Christian, can be counted on and are more reliable than anybody else. And so they got all the nice office jobs, is what actually ended up happening, because of the way that they behave. So you know what? It really pays to be that kind of person. Rule number 6, be a listener. Be a listener. Proverbs 12:15. The way of fools seems right to them, but the wise listen to advice. If you want to be the church at work, then determine to be a listener. First, listen to your coworkers. Just be the person that listens to them. Be the person they can come to with all their issues and their problems. You know, most people are desperate to have somebody who will just listen to them. And so if you become the listener, you're already way ahead of the game. You know, one friend determined to be known as a good listening ear, and as a result, some wonderful things happened. And here's a report from my friend about what happened. He said, there was a woman I worked with who knew that I was a Christian and scoffed at it. She had a relationship with a married man who also worked at the company. They would meet regularly at his lake house. She drove up to meet him one Friday afternoon and found him dead. She was totally devastated and had no one to talk to share her emotions with, because it had all been a big secret. On Monday morning, she was standing at my office door, and she asked if she could talk to me. She closed the door, sat down, and in a veil of tears, told me all the details. And after she collected herself, I asked her if I could pray for her, and she agreed. And before she left, she said, I didn't know who I could go to. I needed someone I thought would understand. I knew you were a Christian and that you won't judge me. Thank you for your kindness and your sensitivity. I just didn't know where else to go. For the rest of my life, I won't forget that. It gives me the courage to press on and be the church at work. So listen to your coworkers. Be a listener. We should also be the ones who listen to advice readily, as the proverb suggests. Be the one that, like, listens to the advice. Find a couple wise people at work or at church and talk to them about how to handle issues and decisions that come up at work, and you'll be a better worker. And finally, and very importantly, be one that listens to God. I think God is interested in your work. And sometimes God might speak to you about your work or about the people at work. That's what Daniel found. He listened to God, and God spoke to him. Because Daniel listened to God, the lives of all his coworkers were saved. They were on the verge of all being slaughtered because they couldn't come up with the dream. Daniel listened, and they were saved. One blogger told this story about listening to God in the workplace. I have a friend named Emeka, who's a lawyer in Nigeria. He was arguing a case before his Supreme Court, and the case had 5 points to argue. And he came to the day of his court case and met with his legal team and his wife. And he always prays about his cases before he enters the courtroom. That day, the Lord spoke to him and said, "Don't argue points 1 to 4, only argue point 5. Now, you can imagine the potential impact of taking such an action if you've not really heard from God. But he obeyed the instructions. He believed God was speaking to him. He entered the courtroom, approached the bench. "Your Honor, I wish to change my plea today and only wish to argue point number 5. "Are you sure you want to do that?" "Yes, Your Honor, that's what I wish to do." So he began his argument and sat down. The opposing attorney stood before the court and for 12 minutes could not get a word out of his mouth. He stumbled this way and that and finally approached the judge and said, "Your Honor, it is unfortunate my learned friends has not chosen to argue points 1 through 4 of this case. I wish to yield the case." You see, the opposing attorney had prepared for points 1 through 4, but not 5. So Emeka won the case. Emeka was successful because he had a secret weapon that God gave him, the power to hear his voice. That's an exciting way to live. Now, I can't promise you that it's always going to work out like that. But you know what? Listening to God is important. It won't make up if you don't do your homework. You know, you can't like cut the corners and be sloppy and then say, "Oh, I'm going to listen to God and God's going to bail me out." Don't count on that. But you should always keep listening, because one day, maybe just one day, maybe when you least expect it, God might actually speak to you in a way that's critical for your work or for somebody else there and make all the difference in the world. Number 7, keep praying. Apparently everybody knew that Daniel was one who regularly prayed to his God. He prayed for his work problems. He prayed for forgiveness. Maybe he prayed for his coworkers. And, you know, the problem is a lot of times we just put up a wall when we go to work. We pray at church, we pray at home, and then we go to work, and we don't pray. But Daniel would say, "Do you pray always for everything in every place, including your workplace?" Now, you don't need to stick it in people's faces. You know, like, don't sit in your cubicle and pray at the top of your voice. Yeah. It's happened. You know, you can be discreet, but pray throughout the day. Pray for your work issues. Pray for the people around you, and always keep alert to people's needs so that you can offer to pray for them as well. Number 8, be the best. It's clear from Daniel's life that over perhaps as much as 50 years, he was consistently the best, and as a result, he had lasting influence. And if you can't be the best one way, try another way to be the best, but always give it your best effort. Or let's think about it this way. How are you going to be the church at work successfully if you're always late and your work is mediocre and you don't prepare and you don't train and you don't get along with anyone and you drop the ball on project after project and no one can count on you? So how do you be the best? Well, ask veterans how to improve. Do work that's above and beyond your job description. Try to do some sort of favor for a coworker every week. That goes a long ways. Work to become not only reliable, but indispensable. That's called unemployment insurance. Work on yourself as well as your work. And always remember that ultimately you are to work as if Jesus was your boss. Number 9, be authentic and transparent. We have to be careful of the plastic image. You know, sometimes people of faith unknowingly make themselves unapproachable and unreal by refusing to be transparent, and we end up projecting a false, almost kind of plastic image. And it can leave our coworkers believing that we live some sort of idealized, perfect life off in never-never land that they can never achieve. Maybe they fear that sharing their struggles, maybe we fear that sharing our struggles with other people at work will reveal a lack of faith. But actually, if we talk about our struggles, others will feel free to talk to us about their struggles. And that's a door to gaining positive influence at work. Besides, the Bible actually calls us to live as people of the light, and that is to live as people who are true and real and seen for what they really are. Ephesians 5, 8-9. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And finally, number 10, socialize with your coworkers. You wouldn't think that that would be a Ten Commandments of be the church at work, but it is. Socialize with your coworkers. Because we need to remember, relationships are what make the difference in life, and that includes our workplaces. Relationships are the deal. We should be building positive relationships with the folks at work, and part of building positive relationships is to socialize. So when everybody goes out to the bar right after work or eat together over lunch or whatever, go with them. You don't have to, like, do all the same things they do or drink as much as they do, but go with them. And yes, I know, sometimes the talk is not so uplifting. And yes, I know there might be some differences in values, but it's still important to socialize. After all, that's what Jesus did. Mark 2, 15-17. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And when the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And on hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." I imagine that the talk at that table might have made you blush as well. But there was Jesus. And you know, most of us are going to spend the biggest bulk of our lives at work. That's where we're going to meet the greatest number of people. And so it has to be a part of our spiritual life. It has to be a part of our faith. And it should be a place where we are a positive influence in all kinds of ways. I have a dream, a dream that no matter what kind of work we do, whether we're moms with kids or students or business people or teachers or manual laborers or whatever, we would all be the best at that work. And that we would all be the unofficial chaplains of our workplaces, in part because we are the best. And then work can truly be a blessing not only to us, but to everyone else. Then work would be fulfilling. Work might even become exciting. And it's all part of what we mean when we say, go out in the world and be the church. Let's stand and we're going to pray. Lord God, I just ask that you will be with each one of us as we go out into the world this week to our workplaces. Would you help us to be more like Daniel, to be people who are a positive influence for you, even in the worst of places and situations. May we be people that give glory to you and that the world looks and says, we are so thankful that those people work here. Would you help us be those kind of people? That's our prayer this week. Amen.